Don Merrill, who we're going to have all the information on CNBC and on our show notes on kboo.fm/thegap. When we asked Don how he measures the impact of his project, he said that he wants to look back and see, look back at the reports and see if they're, if the stop and search reports, to see if there'll be less people getting pulled over for having busted taillights. But he also wants to make sure that there are no other variables that have affected that. So that's something that's also really interesting, because sometimes we think that we, you know, sometimes we're just in a situation where we can't thrive, you know, where it's beyond us, and it's circumstantial, it's situational, and we just cannot, yeah. We cannot, you know, move on. So just wanted, before we wrap up, to give folks a moment of relaxation, because sometimes it's not you. It's literally not you.
Yeah, totally. Be kind to yourself, folks. We are coming right up on it here. Coming up next at 9 is Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott, so stick around for that. You have been listening to The Gap. I'm Althea. Tammy's been here. We got to talk to you. We got to talk to Don Merrill. Check out the show notes, kboo.fm/gap. Thank you, Sonia, as always, for keeping us on the radio. This is KBOO Portland. We'll see you next week. Thank you so much for being with us, and be kind to yourself.
See ya. Happy weekend. Be kind. Bye-bye.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. In 2001, the Aristide Foundation for Democracy in Haiti broke ground on the construction of a medical school. The University of the Aristide Foundation, known as UNIFA, has now expanded to include not only a medical school, but schools of law, nursing, dentistry, physical therapy, and more. The UNIFA campus was shut down and used as a military base by the United States following the 2004 U.S.-backed coup in Haiti. President Aristide and his family remained in exile for 7 years, during which time the Haitian grassroots and their international supporters pressed for their return to their beloved Haiti. Upon his return, President Aristide said his focus would be education, and he was true to his word. And months after his return, the UNIFA campus reopened. Today on Sojourner Truth, you will hear audio from a recent webinar entitled Haiti's Campaign for Dignity. The virtual event featured Haiti's former First Lady, Mildred Aristide, actor and activist Mr. Danny Glover, Congresswoman Maxine Waters of California, also Ira Kurzban, an attorney that has worked for decades in support of the Haitian struggle for democracy, and Dr. Henry Ford of the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. President Biden travels to Georgia to mark his 100th day in office. He'll hold a late afternoon drive-in rally. Last night, Biden delivered his first speech to a joint session of Congress. He celebrated the gains made on combating the coronavirus and vaccinating the U.S. population. Biden also laid out ambitious goals on infrastructure, childcare, and education. Nadia Ramlagan reports.
President Joe Biden made an appeal to blue-collar workers on his $2.3 billion American Jobs Plan, which aims to develop a wide range of infrastructure.
These are good-paying jobs that can't be outsourced. Nearly 90% of the infrastructure jobs created in the American Jobs Plan do not require a college degree. 75% don't require an associate's degree.
Calling for medical innovation, Biden proposed developing a new advanced research projects agency within the National Institutes of Health.
We have a singular purpose, to develop breakthroughs to prevent, detect, and treat diseases like Alzheimer's, diabetes, and cancer.
Biden also wants to boost pay and benefits for home health care workers as the need for their services grows. He says raising taxes on corporations and the country's richest people will make his plan possible and restore fairness to the system.
But it's time for corporate America and the wealthiest 1% of Americans to just begin to pay their fair share.
South Carolina Republican Senator Tim Scott delivered the rebuttal to Biden's address, claiming the president and the Democrats in Congress are pulling America further apart with their policy agenda and calling Biden's infrastructure and American family plan a liberal wish list. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
Federal agents seized computers and cell phones from the home and office of former President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. He has been under federal scrutiny for several years over his lobbying efforts on behalf of Ukraine. The search warrants required approval from the top levels of the Justice Department. Former President Trump told Fox Business that Giuliani was the greatest mayor in the history of New York and a great patriot. He called the raid very, very unfair. The Justice Department has announced federal hate crime charges for three men already facing Georgia state criminal charges in the murder of Ahmaud Arbery. Travis McMichael, his father Gregory, and a friend William Roddy Bryan chased, confronted, and killed Arbery while he was out jogging last year. They claimed they suspected him of robbery. The federal charges include one count of interference with civil rights and attempted kidnapping, also using, carrying, and brandishing a firearm during a crime of violence. Lee Merritt, an attorney for Arbery's mother, tweeted that hate claimed Ahmaud's life. Merritt said the federal case would serve as a failsafe to the state prosecution. A North Carolina judge has denied requests to immediately release police body cam video and the fatal shooting of Andrew Brown Jr. by sheriff's deputies. The judge did order authorities to allow Brown's family to privately view five videos from body cameras and one from a dashboard camera within 10 days, with some portions blurred or redacted. Family members previously had been allowed to view only a 20-second clip from a single body camera. The decision came shortly after a North Carolina prosecutor claimed in court that Andrew Brown Jr. hit law enforcement officers with his car before they opened fire. After the hearing, family attorney Harry Daniels said authorities should release the video so the public can see what really transpired.
An innocent man was gunned down, shot in the back of the head, vehicle riddled with bullets from the rear. Now, I heard statements being made, well, he might have hit the deputies, or he might have did that. Well, show us the video. Show us the video. Show us the tape.
The Pasquotank County Sheriff earlier had said no deputies were injured by Brown. India has set another global record in new recorded coronavirus cases, more than 379,000 new infections reported in the latest 24-hour period. The health ministry also reported 3,645 deaths in the last day. Both figures are certainly undercounts. Daily deaths have nearly tripled in the past 3 weeks. Hospitals in New Delhi are beyond capacity. All Indians 18 and older are now allowed to register on a government app for vaccinations that are supposed to start on Saturday. But social media were flooded with complaints that the app crashed due to high use, and once it was working again, no appointments were available. I'm Eileen Alfandari for Pacifica Radio.
Those were our news headlines. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and you will now hear audio from a recent webinar entitled Haiti's Campaign for Dignity. During today's program, you will hear from Haiti's former First Lady Mildred Aristide, actor and activist Mr. Danny Glover, Congresswoman Maxine Waters of California, Ira Kurzman, an attorney, Dr. Henry Ford, of the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. The webinar was moderated by Laura Flynn, who is on the board of UNIFA.
My name is Laura Flynn. I want to welcome you all on behalf of the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund. We've organized this webinar today to tell the story of UNIFA, the medical and university in Haiti. The Haiti Emergency Relief Fund was founded in the aftermath of the 2004 coup in Haiti, to provide direct support to grassroots organizations and institutions fighting for justice and democracy in Haiti. I'm thrilled to be doing this. UNIFA is one of my favorite places on earth, and as you will hear, it's basically a miracle. Without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Danny Glover, who doesn't need a huge introduction. I think we all know he is an actor and activist who's visited Haiti numerous times, and he's been a steadfast supporter of the work of UNIFA for many years. He's probably better known for many other roles, but I know my favorite role was when he participated in a reenactment of the Haitian, a theatrical reenactment of the Haitian Revolution at the Haitian National Palace on the bicentennial of the revolution in 2004. So let me welcome Danny.
Thank you so much, Laura. And thank you for all those who are joining us here for this very special moment. Any moment, any time I get to celebrate Haiti, but most notably the Haitian people, it's one of the great honors for me and one of the great privileges for me. And I say that with privilege in so many ways, as I remember back the period, my whole life with Haiti. And most times that people refer to me, have asked me whether I'm Haitian, and I've always used Frederick Douglass's great statement that he's a Haitian at heart, that I'm a Haitian at heart, and always will be. When I think about the heroic struggles of the Haitian people, it is the most extraordinary moment in human history. Everything that's happened in Haiti, it's translated in such a way that it's been transformative for all of us. The real meaning at that very key moment, the real meaning for all men are created equal was created in Haiti in 1804, and we must never forget that. The first time I came to Haiti is about 2 years out of college in 1973, and I just wanted to go there. I had read certainly the great C.L.R. James's The Black Jacobins, and so it was itself a kind of calling, as if I had this calling to go to Haiti. But never would I would have been in my most amazing, in my most wildest dream as a young man finishing college. Never would I anticipate that I've had the privilege of having the relationship that I've had with Haiti over the last nearly 30 years. And certainly, and there's so many faces that we talk about and so many ways in which we talk about the struggles that we've encountered in Haiti from the moment that my little brother, President Aristide was elected. From that moment, from the coup, Randall Robinson and the hunger strike that he went on in order to have the democracy come back to Haiti and the reestablishment of our friend and our president, President Aristide. All those were the things that just a template of the opportunities that I have to engage with the Haitian people, whether it was at the bicentennial, at an extraordinary bicentennial, imagine 200 years old in 2004. All those things have been important to me. And certainly I've talked about Haiti through my desire, which continues to be my desire to make a movie on that, about that great moment in Haitian history, but in world history. the transformative moment that happened in world history. In fact, my company that does extraordinary work, film company called Louverture Films, know them in homage to and respect to the great liberator and all, and all those people, and how it singly every day, as you say, that Laura, as you say, that they teach us about resistance. I don't care where they are in the world. If you talk to labor unions, organized labor, and you talk about who some of the most explicit and most extraordinary organizers in their union, often you find that they're Haitians, and in that sense, because why wouldn't they be? They organized a revolution and were successful in the revolution, the most successful revolution, I would say, and the first victory of Africans against the worldwide institution of slavery, the first victory there. And so you have to be there. And the role that they played historically, whether it's Simone Bolivar coming to André Pétion, you know, and beginning to come and receive resources in order to liberate South America, you know. So all these histories that come into that we don't know, we're experiencing something in this moment in our own country and in the world, and particularly about this country. As Baldwin said, when we cannot tell the truth about our past, we become trapped in it. We're trapped in our past, whether it comes to our understanding of who the Haitian people represent, what they represent, not singly just to that island, but what they represent to the world and represent to the hemisphere itself. So to the work that we need to do continues. Every moment that Haitian people on the island resist the oppression that they are, that underscores their history, every moment is a challenge for us to meet with them and whatever they do. The Haitian Emergency Relief Fund is one part of that. The extraordinary idea of building a hospital to service the Haitian people is another. It's grassroots. It's from the bottom of our hearts and from the bottom of the Haitian people as well. So it's a privilege for me to be at this particular moment as we continue. As we would say often in Portuguese, a luta continua, the struggle continues.
We are so honored to have Congresswoman Maxine Waters with us today. Congresswoman Waters, we'd like to welcome you to this webinar. Congresswoman Waters is serving her 15th term in Congress from the 43rd District of California. She made history as the first woman and first African-American chair of the House Financial Services Committee. She's been an utterly fearless advocate for women, children, people of color, and the poor. She has been the foremost voice in Congress for democracy and human rights in Haiti. And those of us close to Haiti and to the Aristides know just how deep a personal debt that Haiti owes to Maxine. So without further ado, we turn it over to you, Congresswoman Waters.
Well, thank you so very, very much. I was excited when I got the invitation to participate today, for so many reasons. You know, this webinar gives me the opportunity to reconnect with a number of people. But first, let me say that I am just so proud of Mildred Aristide. I'm so proud of her for the work that she has done for so long. And this very, very special effort that she has made to do what perhaps many folks thought could not be done. She is establishing this teaching hospital, and it's amazing the work that she's done to get it started, to get it going. As a matter of fact, when this teaching hospital is completed, she will have, and the island will have, and Haiti will have, the people will have, trained physicians and others who work in that hospital setting because of the efforts that she has made, the Aristide Foundation, in training and developing doctors and lawyers and nurses and so many other professions that they have developed in the teaching and training overall that they have done under this foundation. So first I'd like to say hello to Mildred Aristide, former First Lady of Haiti. And of course, I always send my regards to President Aristide. Now, taking a look at all of the participants today, Danny Glover, I told Danny the last time I saw him, he's everywhere. I don't know how he manages his time, but he does a remarkable job of being where he needs to be. Good to see you, Danny. Also, I'm very, very pleased about all of the others who are on today, but Ira Kurzban is a special man. I want you to know I've been thinking about you, Ira. I have not seen you for a long time, but I know that you're doing the work that you've always done. Civil rights and immigration attorney who spent decades, as is indicated here, fighting for the rights of immigrants and refugees. And you and I have been together on some extraordinary journeys. And the most interesting one was when we were put off the plane together in Haiti. And I've never forgotten that incident, but you are such a brave soul who have been here on behalf of Haiti, on behalf of the Aristides, on behalf of doing everything that you possibly could do to try and bring the democracy to Haiti that it needs and it deserves. And so here we are. And on my recent visit, the last visit that I was on, I think it was maybe late last year, I had the opportunity not only to go to a great meeting that was put together at the university, but I also had the opportunity to view the plans of the teaching hospital and to go on the site and to walk through with Mildred exactly what was being built, how it was being laid out, and already much of the groundwork had been done at that time. And so I know that this not only is a tremendous effort, but a very worthwhile effort, but it's going to need resources. It's going to need all of us to do everything that we can to ensure that this teaching hospital is completed, that it has all of the equipment that it needs, that it is a place where all of these trained people, Haitians, all of these trained Haitians, trained by the university, can go to work and can do what they have been taught and what they have learned to do, and to have the kind of careers that a lot of folks never anticipated. And so I'm delighted to be with you all today, and for Laura Flynn and Henry Ford, MD, MHA, and for Karanda Harmon, I'm delighted to have joined you here today with Danny Glover and my friend Ira Kurzban to talk about what can be done with this Haiti Emergency Relief Fund. I know that, you know, as we watch what is going on in Haiti, we're pained, and we just believe that we have to continue the struggle for freedom and for justice and for democracy. And perhaps, you know, we'll have a little bit of time for someone to start the conversation relative to that. But today, this is about UNIFA, the University of the Dr. Aristide Foundation. This is organized by the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund. And so we've got to concentrate on what we can do to be of support in the best way that we possibly can so that this teaching hospital can become everything that Mildred Aristide and the foundation have envisioned. This is a vision that was started with the Aristides and with the foundation. This is a vision that has become a reality. And so here I am, and I wish I could do a lot more. I wish I could get to Haiti a lot more often. We need to be there We need to be dealing with what is going on right now with this president. We need to understand what is happening to so many good people who have been beaten and, you know, houses burned, all of that. But let me just continue in the way that I believe that Mildred would like us to continue today. And let's focus on UNIFA, and let's focus on the mission that we're here to support. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And I'm just going to be here with you as I listen to everybody. Thank you.
All right, now I'm going to turn it over to Mildred Trouillot-Aristide, the former First Lady of Haiti. She is an attorney, author, and member of the Board of Administration of the Université de la Fondation Aristide, UNIFA. She's also one of my oldest friends. We've been working together for over 30 years. She is an absolute model of resilience, I would say. She has had to pick her life back up and put it together so many times. It's astounding. And when we say that she's deeply involved with UNIFA, yes, she's leading on the vision, and she's helping raise the funds, and she's talking to the people building, but she's also there every day and is the person who knows where all the keys are and has to worry about when the electricity goes out and all of the massive problems that come with administrating a major institution in Haiti. So she is both on the ground making it happen and also reaching out beyond Haiti to build the support for this visionary university. And I'm going to turn, she's going to tell us a whole lot more about the history and then the dream for building this teaching hospital on the campus at UNIFA. Welcome, Mildred.
Thank you very much, Laura, for that really kind introduction. Danny, Congresswoman Waters, thank you for your powerful testimonies. And it is wonderful to be with you, even though we're not all together, but it just feels so right and so together. I hope that everyone who is attending and on this Zoom call is keeping safe and well. And I thank you for carving out this moment during these troubling times to have this conversation about our project for a teaching hospital at our university, UNIFA, here in Haiti. I know that your energy and your minds are rightfully occupied by the COVID-19 pandemic, the police murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor. This struggle for racial equality in the United States is shining a light not only on injustice in the US, but really throughout the world. And under these circumstances, I am most respectful of your commitment to engage with us today on our project to spend this time together. A UNIFA teaching hospital is really a charge statement. And so it may not be the first thing you think about when you think of Haiti's multitude of needs. So why a teaching hospital and why now? The project demands interrogation. And it has to be seen against the backdrop of the times that we're living in, that the world is living in. Because we're in the summer of 2020, of course, I will speak to the impact of COVID-19 on our project. If we were in January of 2010, I would speak to the impact of the earthquake that killed over 300,000 people. If it were 2012, we would talk about the impact of cholera outbreak right after the earthquake that killed over 10,000 people. If it were 2014, the chikungunya and the Zika viruses that infected probably half of our population. If it was 2015, our conversation would probably also center on the deadly hurricanes that hit the country that year. The connective tissue of all of these events is that they laid bare the absence of any real public healthcare system in Haiti. This was most evident to the world after the earthquake, when medical missions from everywhere rushed to bring emergency and life-saving care to Haiti. These catastrophes also underscored the persistence of diseases that are directly linked to hunger, poverty, environmental degradation, repression, and violence in Haiti. And they amplify the urgency to train skilled healthcare workers to meet the healthcare needs of our population, training that must take place in large part at a university teaching hospital. Each word, UNIFA, teaching, hospital, Haiti, requires some breaking down. And I'd like to start with Haiti. And I know that Danny and Laura gave a good setup as to the history of Haiti. And we who are involved with Haiti, know Haiti, always have to go to the history because it is so important to the present. My goal today is to show you that a teaching hospital in Haiti, no matter how far away Haiti may sound from where you are sitting right now this afternoon, but it intersects with the global struggle across the world that is converging into really one struggle for human dignity. Healthcare is a basic human right, but one that has long not been available to most Haitians. The same is true for education. We are trying to forge a pathway towards training a greater number of healthcare professionals precisely because it addresses both needs, health and education. And as Congresswoman Waters says, at the same time, we are training citizens to be humanly connected to one another and increasing the number of skilled and active citizens able to affect change. We believe strongly that the teaching hospital is an important space where this can happen. Since Haiti's emergence, we have always stood at the crossroads of a struggle for dignity. And here I'll go to my brief examples from our history, because they really are important to what we're experiencing today. Of course, in history, the most basic of our struggles was the struggle for our humanity. As Danny said, in 1804, an army of former slaves abolished slavery. It was the first country to ever do that. But in our backyard loomed heavy the presence of a giant slave nation, the United States. And all around us, encircling us in the Caribbean Sea, the slave colonies of Europe's great powers, France, England, and Spain. So we were boycotted and isolated. In 1825, on the threat of re-enslavement, Haiti was forced to pay a blood debt to France. Former slaves paid reparations to former slave masters. The amount represented France's annual budget and 10 years of revenue for Haiti. And by the time these debts ended, well into the 20th century, the debt had crossed the ocean, moving from France to an American bank. Then in a 19-year U.S. occupation that started in 1915 and gave rise to a murderous Haitian army, responsible for repression and political instability for much of our history. For decades, the leadership of that army was trained at a U.S. army named after a U.S. Confederate general, Fort Benning in Georgia. And up until the waning days of the 35-year Duvalier dictatorship, both Duvalier father and son were supported with financial assistance and military assistance by the international community. These are just some of the things and some of the ways that show that Haiti has never lived separately from the political and economic realities of world affairs. These events crippled our nation's development. Persistent racism, social and economic exclusion, political corruption and instability, layered on top of those events, are the challenges that prevent Haiti from being whole. And it persists. From October to early December of last year, before the coronavirus had triggered the worldwide lockdown, the virus of poverty, repression, and hunger had triggered a national lockdown here in Haiti. We called it Pays Lock, country locked. Schools, banks, government offices, everything was closed. Neighborhoods and roads were barricaded. People demanding their human dignity, Haitians collectively asking to breathe.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a quick station break. When we return, you will hear more from our special Haiti's Campaign for Dignity. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Thank you. Welcome back to Sojourner Truth. Check us out on our website at sotrueradio.org. If you're on Facebook, you can look for us and like us there. We're also nationwide and worldwide on SoundCloud. You can go to the search bar and type in Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott to find us. Now we return to the webinar, Haiti's Campaign for Dignity. During the second half of today's program, you will hear more from Haiti's former First Lady, Mildred Aristide, attorney Ira Kurzban, and Dr. Henry Ford of the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. Let's hear from them now.
Now, I want to focus a little bit on UNIFA. UNIFA was founded by my husband, President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, in 2001 during his second term as president. At the time, the country had a very robust medical training program with Cuba. So each year, up to 50 to 60 Haitian university students were enrolled in Cuban medical schools. In the 15-plus history of this program, over 700 Haitian doctors have been trained. We took it one step further in creating UNIFA, a medical school with a teaching staff that was composed of professors from Cuba, but situated here in Haiti. At the time, we had three goals, and those three goals continue to guide us: to prepare doctors to also care for the poorest of the poor with a more humanistic approach, to increase the number of doctors practicing in the rural areas where there is almost an absence of any kind of care, and to break down the long tradition of exclusion of the poor majority in Haiti from access to higher education. Our vision was to create this safe learning environment so that young Haitians could begin and continue to think critically about our country, an institution to address our national issues, Haitians to train, Haitian problems, as we like to say. By the end of our first 2 years, in the fall of 2003, there were approximately 240 students enrolled in our medical school. Now, for those of you who may be familiar with Haitian politics, you may know that shortly after the fall of 2003, specifically February 2004, there was a coup d'etat against President Aristide's government. It was the 32nd coup in the country's history. It came just months after President Aristide announced that it was time to open discussions with France on restitution and reparations for the debt extorted from Haiti in 1825. A Haitian government commission of economists estimated the present-day value of the debt at over $21 billion. I can tell you that the request for dialogue did not go very well, and it was not very well received. Within days after the 2004 coup, the international military force that had arrived in Haiti forced the 240 students off campus, and UNIFA transformed from university to military installation. Meanwhile, my two daughters, my husband and I spent 7 years in exile in South Africa. When we were able to return in 2011, in March of 2011, with great assistance from Maxine Water and Danny Glover, who was with us on that flight, Ira, we immediately set about to reopen UNIFA. We had to. And so in October of that first year, 2011, we reopened UNIFA. And again, we started with the medical school with some of the same professors from Cuba who had been there in 2004. And most importantly, the 240 UNIFA students who somehow continued their education in Cuba and were back in Haiti. Not all of them, but many of them. And of course, with much assistance from HERF and the Haitian Action Committee, we were able to clean up the campus and begin, 126 students back in 2011. 9 years later, we've added six more schools. Today, our teaching staff is 100% Haitian. There are still some of the Cubans who are with us, but we're mostly a Haitian staff. In the area of health sciences, in addition to medicine, we've added nursing, dentistry, and physical therapy. In fact, our School of Physical Therapy is the first university-level PT program in Haiti. As you can well imagine, a vitally needed service since the 2010 earthquake, which left tens of thousands of people injured and in need of therapy. We also have the law school, a school of engineering, architecture, and a school of administration. And this year, we added a school of agriculture. Enrollment currently stands at approximately 2,002 students, a drop in the bucket when you consider the education needs in Haiti. An average Haitian who is 25 years or older has less than 5 years of schooling, and about 50% of children don't attend school. Every year, approximately 40 to 45,000 students complete high school and pass the state mandate exam, and they are theoretically eligible for entry into the university system. But there are not nearly enough university seats available to meet this need. Historically, those who can have gone to the United States, the Dominican Republic, Canada, or France for their university studies, but economically, that is becoming less and less of an option. And it's clearly not the solution for Haiti. Today, the hardships in Haiti are forcing our young people, skilled workers, construction workers, electricians, to flee to go to places as far as Panama, Brazil, and Chile. The dream of a visa cannot fuel the future of our country. Since we reopened in 2011, we have maintained our tuition lower than all the comparable universities in order to keep UNIFA accessible to as many Haitians as possible. We have a large campus in the country. It's the largest campus in the country, and it's situated about 4 miles from the airport, for those of you who may know Haiti. And we are in Tabar, which is a municipality that experienced a surge in the population following the 2010 earthquake. The academic buildings sit on 33 acres, and there is a sports field, a residential campus that is progressively growing to accommodate more students and professors. Right now, we have about 70 residents on the campus. Across the 7 schools, we have 109 professors, and we welcome visiting professors from the United States and abroad. For instance, just last year, Dr. Douglas Gross from the California School, Davis School of Medicine, led a 5-day neuroanatomy seminar for our third year students, which we opened up to other medical students. Interestingly, Dr. Gross first came to Haiti on one of those medical missions who came in after the earthquake. And after 2 years of coming back to provide clinical assistance, he realized that his skills as a professor would be better spent in the field of medical education. And so he's committed to coming and coming back and teaching at UNIFA. And of course, we prize our Haitian diaspora and encourage them also to continue to be engaged as instructors at UNIFA. We are proud that in the last 9 years since we reopened, we have graduated 3 classes in medicine, nursing, and law, and 2 classes in physical therapy. In total, we've added to the population 378 doctors, 97 nurses, 26 physical therapists, and 51 lawyers. A growing cohort of young professionals with a tool to enter the workforce in Haiti. Young professionals who have already demonstrated a commitment to be active participants of change in Haiti. Just this past week, I was at a nearby hospital with my father when I was approached by a young man who announced that he was a proud graduate of UNIFA, now working at the hospital. So those moments always make us feel very, very proud and very, very, very clear that we have to continue on this path. Now, I'd like to focus a little bit on the training that our students in the health sciences receive. Students in medicine, nursing, dentistry, and physical therapy must, of course, have clinical training as part of their training. Right now, to meet this requirement, we are forced to parcel out our students to over 10 facilities across Haiti. Because of that, UNIFA does not have 100% control over this important part of their education. The institutions receiving our students charge a significant monthly fee, plus we have to pay the hospital staff doctors who oversee the training. After their 5th year of classroom instruction, medical students are required to complete a 1-year internship. This year, we had 136 interns. And then after the internship, they must fulfill what is called a year of social service, which is traditionally the placement in a medical facility or a public health facility, usually outside the capital where access to health is most limited. And then when they finish that year of social service, for those who are lucky, there are very, very few number of residency seats where students can go on to specialize in a particular area of medicine. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, clinical training of our non-intern students had to be suspended. for our interns, the experience was mixed. They were assigned to three different state hospitals, but not all of the facilities were fully functioning. And in order for our students to work, we had to provide them with about $10,000 worth of protective equipment, in addition to having to pay the monthly fees and the doctor's fees that are required. In 2017, UNIFA decided to open a small clinic at our foundation's community center, which is not far from the university. We hired two dentists, installed two fully equipped dental chairs, hired an internist, a nurse, and an ophthalmologist. And steadily, over the past 3 years, we have invested to increase the range of services and the number of physicians. We added a pharmacy, a laboratory, and a small outpatient surgery unit. We now have 7 dental chairs, and we hired on staff 2 doctors from our first graduating class. And last year, our clinic was certified by the Ministry of Health to serve as a training site for our students, albeit limited given the size. Every year, as was explained in the video, we sponsor 4 to 5 open houses where consultations and prescribed medicines are given freely to the community members who come. And we receive between 500 and 700 people on that very long day that we have these events. UNIFA students are required to participate in these mobile clinics, and they do assist the doctors. The clinic was our first step in not only providing healthcare to our immediate community, but developing this clinical training for our students. In 2018, we took the next step, and the UNIFA board decided to create a fund to begin construction on our own teaching hospital. We commissioned an architect to begin working on a plan. When my husband, President Aristide, became Haiti's first democratically elected president back in 1991, his rallying call was "Tout moun se moun." Every person is a human being. Poor lives matter, Black lives matter. His vision sounded simple, but was hugely profound. It was to move the country from misery to poverty with dignity. This vision continues to guide us. By educating the daughters and sons of domestic workers, subsistence farmers, market women, factory workers, teachers, street vendors, taxi drivers, Moun Andoyo, the historically excluded, Haiti is affirming this truth and is fully engaged in the struggle for dignity for all. I thank you for your time and for your attention.
Right now, I want to go to Dr. Ari Ford, who's the Dean and Chief Academic Officer at the University of Miami, Leonard M. Miller School of Medicine. He's a Haitian-born pediatric surgeon. And Dr. Ford returns regularly to Haiti to provide medical care. And as you've heard, he's also lectured at UNIFA and so knows well the situation on the ground and also UNIFA's, the role that UNIFA can play. So we just wanted to ask you to say a little bit more, Dr. Ford, about the situation, the healthcare situation in Haiti and how what role you feel that UNIFA's teaching hospital can play.
Thank you so much, Laura, for the opportunity to speak and to be part of this really outstanding panel. I'm truly humbled to be in such an amazing company. Mildred, all I can say is wow, double wow. What an inspiring delivery. You really put together the picture in such a way that no one else can, and with a certain eloquence and really empathy because you're living it. And you really, even as one who goes back and forth to Haiti all the time, you made it real. So thank you so very much. I'm deeply moved. In fact, I decided to dispense with my prepared remarks because you inspired me so much. And I'm gonna be relatively brief. I was born in Haiti. I left my country just before I turned 14 and grew up in Brooklyn and New Jersey for college and then Boston, med school, back to New York and eventually ended up in Los Angeles where I was when the Haiti earthquake hit. And this is, even though I had been going back and forth on some mission work in Haiti, I recognized at that time that Haiti didn't need my money only, where it always needs the money, But they also needed my skills, my talent as a pediatric surgeon. I was the chief of surgery at Children's in LA at the time. And after, and I flew shortly after the earthquake to Port-au-Prince and as part of the team that was deployed by the Department of Health and Human Services, the DMAT insert team. I can say that after spending two of the most grueling weeks of my life trying to help save lives, trying to help alleviate some of the suffering of the Haitian people who had been victimized by this devastating earthquake, I recognize that this is not one of those situations where you could say it's one and done. Haiti was suffering from a profound lack of a healthcare infrastructure, which is why we saw so many deaths. And in addition to that, there were so many people who were badly injured and critically wounded in such a way that they had more amputees than anyone could ever envision. Hence the need to have a physical therapy school. So after that particular engagement, it became clear to me that I needed to continue to go back to help shore up that healthcare infrastructure. So I started to go back to Haiti to work with some of the medical students, with some of the deans to reform the or revamp the medical school curriculum, and also to teach some of the Haitian surgery residents and practicing surgeons how to take care of neonatal surgical emergencies, because a lot of babies were really dying unnecessarily of very pedestrian problems that in any other developed country, they manage to find a cure for. So having said that, that has been the engagement. And it was shortly after their return to Haiti that I had the privilege of meeting with Mildred and former President Aristide. And there I heard their bold vision to create this educational ecosystem, a model very much after the best North American universities in UNIFA. This was the transformational idea that they had. And I must say, I had some skepticism that you could pull this off. But if anybody can do it, it's really Mildred and the former president. They are relentless, they're resilient, and they have a vision to transform the country into and recognizing that it's education. It's about equipping the Haitian people with the right tools, education and some kind of a vocational skill that's going to get us out of the conditions that we find ourselves in. Which is why I have continued to support UNIFI in so many ways. After we separated conjoined twins in Haiti for the very first time, the place where we gave the more or less press conference and the first academic conference was at UNIFI, because it was important for these students to understand what is possible, because I am just like all of them. We have a number of exceptionally talented, bright students at UNIFA who ask the most provocative questions. And you can see the thirst for knowledge, the thirst for the hunger for access to the best technology, for them to be able to become the best physicians and the best healthcare professionals that they can be. And this has been truly very moving. So Haiti needs more doctors. In order for us to have more doctors, we need to have a medical school. But in order for these medical students to actually train and for these residents to ever ultimately become practicing physicians, we need hospitals. And here comes the argument for why we need to have a teaching hospital affiliated with the medical school. There is no question that it is of a paramount importance. We just don't have enough hospital beds in the country, and this is a unique opportunity for us to not only undergird the amazing work that's taking place at UNIFA, but also to provide the students, the medical students and residents, an opportunity to train in a state-of-the-art hospital so that they can help meet the needs of the country in not only providing care now, but also in the future. So to me, the success of this ecosystem that's being built, or that they have already built, depends largely on completing the next step, which is to erect that teaching hospital. So I couldn't be more supportive, more excited about it, more eager to actually do all we can to ensure its success, both in my capacity as a dean of the University of Miami Middle School of Medicine, but also as a native Haitian. Thank you very much, Laura.
And now I'm going to turn to our final speaker, Ira Kurzban, who's going to bring it home for us. Ira is a civil rights and immigration attorney who spent decades fighting for the rights of immigrants and refugees. He was the counsel for the government of Haiti from 1991 to 2004, some very tumultuous years. And also an old friend of mine, comrade in this struggle of many Haiti triumphs and tribulations. So our question for you, Ira, is you've worked with the Aristides for over 30 years. Much of that work has focused on guaranteeing basic human rights, whether it was through government, through education, through healthcare. And I'm wondering how you see the work of UNIFA around both education and healthcare in that long arc of the struggle for human rights in Haiti.
I've spent virtually my entire legal career fighting for justice and dignity for Haitian refugees in the United States and the people of Haiti. And I was privileged to work with the democratically elected governments of Haiti from 1991 to 2004. Most privileged, of course, to work with President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. You know, I understood from the very beginning of my work with Haitian refugees and then with the people of Haiti that human rights and political and legal rights are intertwined. We cannot have a fair and just legal or political system unless we have healthy, educated citizens. After all, how can we teach people about the rule of law who are too sick to go to school, too weak from illness to vote, too worried about finding clean water to support democracy? Health is a human right, and without it, all the other political and social and legal rights can never be fully effectuated. In the years we spent to end impunity for wrongdoing in Haiti, we found that the Haitian people courageously and without hesitation sought justice. But justice comes in many forms. Justice is the right to live without violence, to educate your children, whether or not you are wealthy, to drink clean water, to have a roof over your head, and to have access to health care. I stand with the Aristides in their struggle over the last 30 years to achieve that kind of justice for Haiti and for the Haitian people. You know, when President Aristide returned to Haiti in 2011, he made a promise to the Haitian people that he would dedicate his life to education, to the rule of law, and to the health of its citizens. And every day he has sought to fulfill that promise. But no person can accomplish this goal alone. The health of the Haitian people is more precarious than ever. Haiti, you know, has endured earthquakes, cholera, hurricanes, and now the coronavirus. We also know that the more a population is vulnerable to general ill health, the easier the coronavirus can spread. And we, unfortunately, in the U.S. have not helped Haiti. In fact, unfortunately, the opposite is true. By knowingly and intentionally deporting Haitians to Haiti that have contracted COVID-19, we have harmed the people of Haiti. Instead of treating Haitians in the U.S. with COVID-19, we've deported them and thus helped to spread the virus in the most vulnerable place in this hemisphere. We owe the Haitian people at least the ability to take care of themselves, to train doctors and nurses and other healthcare professionals in Haiti to help the country. Thank you very much.
We're out of time. I'd like to thank all of the speakers featured on today's program. And we want to thank the Haiti Action Committee and Haiti Emergency Relief Fund. It was the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund that organized the webinar. I would also like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, Romero Funes, our assistant producer, and today's audio engineer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. And remember to visit our website, sotrueradio.org, and follow us on Facebook, our handle on Twitter and Instagram, at SoTrueRadio. Thank you so much for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Y'all stay safe now.
Solomon saying that you're listening to non-commercial, listener-sponsored, volunteer-driven community radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.